I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The Bulger brothers, Jimmy and Bill, have been the biggest Boston Irish family story since the Kennedys. A sort of nightmare rewriting of Boston politics that made the whole town feel meaner and smaller than it was or is. From the 1970s through the 90s, William Bulger presided over the state senate and then the University of Massachusetts. His older brother, Whitey, was the killer boss of drug crime, loan sharking, organized violence in Boston and beyond. And the dreaded power of the Bulgers together felt irresistible, a lot of times unspeakable, and still unfathomable. Johnny Powers, who preceded Bill Bulger in South Boston politics and the Senate presidency, and who detested the Bulgers, put it to me once, it's as if Al Capone's brother was president of the Illinois State Senate and everybody pretended not to notice. The gruesome assassination this week of Whitey Bulger in a federal prison in West Virginia, where he had just taken up residence, marks one more bitter end of a long-gone era. Howie Carr of the Boston Herald in our studio is our witness that the unimaginable Bulger story was never unwritable. Howie, you made a career of writing the Bulger story in the paper and in hardcovers. You struck us all as fearless, even funny about it, at the risk, we thought, of your life. So you get forgiven for all your other sins. Welcome back to this studio, Howie Carr.
Thanks, Monsignor. What's my penance?
You got to write about him some more. And tell us, have we come to the end of the story?
I think so, Chris. Yeah, it's an exclamation point, I would say. And there's nothing left. I mean, none of the Bulgers are coming back. It's not a dynasty, even a Kennedy-type dynasty, you know.
In Hollywood, it might be a dynasty. Ray Donovan, the latest incarnation of the Bulger type on HBO, I guess.
Yeah, I heard actually that, suddenly Hollywood is again interested in Boston underworld, at least for a few hours.
Speak about it, you know, the way we all do. And we were all scared that Bulger would see us in the street one time or something, or we'd see him. Don't you miss having talked to him?
No.
I mean, as long as he was held down or something.
Right. I mean, I was glad not to talk to him. I remember one time I talked to Stevie Flemmy in court, and he said, you know, Howie, Whitey always was talking about you. I said, that's what I heard, Stevie, you know, and but what would I have talked to him about? I mean, he would have just threatened me.
I just keep wondering if there is, you know, Dostoevsky wrote The Brothers Karamazov. I would love to have written The Brothers Bulger and some sort of compassionate insight into evil or something.
But, I mean, what compassion could you have for the guy? I mean, think of all the terrible stories
He's still a human being, as we say. And how did he get that way? How they rose, how they managed in this super respectable town. I mean, Bill Bulger on the MGH board, on the Boston Symphony board. How did they pull that off?
Well, I think wasn't part of Billy Bulger's power the unspoken menace of Whitey behind him. I mean, we have this sound cut we're going to play at some point, which I think indicates the malign.
Let's
power.
Get into it. I mean, it was always the question. So people said, "Well, you know, Bill Bulger, he knows Latin, and he
doesn't have a TV.
Reads through the middle of the night and all that
and
stuff.
He has a brogue."
When he wants to. But at the same time, you're right. Let's play that tape. This was Kevin White, mayor of Boston in the 70s. He blurted out that unspoken dread when he thought our television interview was all over. 1978, the mayor had just been reelected to a third term. Bill Bulger was rising to the top of the state senate. And Kevin White was feeling personally threatened and upset with reporters like me for undercovering the unsavory connections here. Here is Kevin.
No. You don't want to touch the tough one. Now, I don't want to because I like Bill. On examination, in my opinion,
I like Bill too.
But the point is, if my brother threatened to kill you, or you thought he would kill you, you would be nothing but nice to me. Just wouldn't want to get too close to investigating the mayor. In truth, that says a hell of a lot about you. And this is friends. Mm-hmm. No. I know how you feel. I know what it is in the 75 fight to realize at the end, no, the mob was in the fight. A blind man knew that. And if they shot me, they win all the marbles. So why not shoot the son of a bitch? Do you know what it was for me? I'm not exaggerating. I realized in busing one night, came out of the club at the tennis club at 11 o'clock at night in the parking lot with my car. I never was scared in my life. I almost slept in the club. Because I figured if they pumped me out, which why not Whitey would be? They were crazy enough then to do it to me. Mm-hmm. Then they drew Jerry O'Leary as council president. But that says a lot, and I'm not a heroic.
That was Kevin Voigt voicing a fantasy, a dread. But a lot of people had that feeling, Howie, and
right.
didn't want to speak about it.
Well, because, you know, not only was Whitey killing people, he was also disappearing people. You know, I mean, you know, you spoke out or, you know, you somehow crossed him. And all of a sudden, you weren't just dead in the street. You were gone. You were vanished. You were departed. And I think that was part of the scariness, the terror that he spread.
Can you reconstruct the growth of that family? You called them the crime family out of the project in South Boston.
Right. Well, Whitey was a bank robber early on, and he started out as a tailgater stealing stuff. He was always a bad guy. There's an interesting thing from his Air Force records, Chris. He was up for a court martial or something, you know. This was in like the early 1950s. He was in Butte, Montana, and there's a transcript. And one of his commanding officers says something like, "Bulger, you better watch it because if you don't get in line, you're going to get a dishonorable discharge, and you won't be able to get a good job when you get out of the military." And Whitey Bulger said, he's like 23 years old, he says, "The kind of job I'm going to have, it doesn't really matter what kind of discharge I get from the Air Force." And that's back in 52, 53. And he was also already dropping John McCormick's name, who was then, I guess, the majority whip or the majority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives. So Whitey gets out of the Air Force, and he comes back to South Boston, and he gets into like small time petty crime, and he starts robbing banks with an older crew, and he gets eventually caught and sentenced to 9 years in federal prison. George Sweeney was the judge. Judge Sweeney, he's the one who tried to give Suffolk Downs to Joe Kennedy back in the 40s. It's all interconnected. And so he goes away to prison, and Billy is meanwhile like the intellect in the family, the bookworm, and he goes to BC. He gets elected to the House of Representatives in 60, and Whitey is still in prison. He undergoes the LSD experiments in Atlanta.
Right.
Then he gets transferred to Alcatraz. He's one of the legendary prison in the Bay in San Francisco. Whitey gets out in 65. Fortuitously for him, misses almost the entire Irish gang war. So all the people that are in his generation in organized crime, Italians and Irish, are getting wiped out. And he's on ice, basically. And so he comes out. He's had all this time to learn, to think about his mistakes as a callow bank robber. And he comes out and he goes to work for Donald Killeen, who was like, yeah, you could tell us about Donald Killeen.
Well, I knew Donald Killeen, not well, but he hung out at a restaurant near where I lived, and I shook his hand numerous times. I never met a bigger hand. I mean, he was like shaking hands with a cement block, tough as nails, and yet likable, sociable.
Yeah.
And but then it's universally assumed that it was Whitey who brought him out onto the lawn.
It was done at Whitey's behest. I think Whitey always denied that he did it.
I think Whitey was there.
You think he was there?
I think that was the Killeen family line.
In Framingham? This was in Framingham.
He was
called out.
All because he wanted the Upham's Corner booking, you know, territory for himself, presumably.
Right. Well, I think more or less, though, at that point, the Mullen gang, the Mullins, they were younger. That was Pat Nee and the McGonagalls and that crowd. They were all Vietnam vets or that age group. They were moving in on the Killeens, who were older. And Donald Killeen and his brothers hired a guy named O'Sullivan and Whitey as their muscle. And the Killeens were on the short end of the stick, and Whitey thought he was going to get killed. So he went to Johnny Modorano, and because Johnny Modorano owed a favor to Billy O'Sullivan because he'd wrecked one of his bars by shooting someone in the bar the night Billy O'Sullivan opened it up. So he always owed Billy.
Oh, it's amazing. Whenever you start talking much less writing about this stuff, it sounds like all of Ireland is here, and they're all gunmen, right?
Well, you know...
What do you get against my people?
They're my people too, Chris. Half my people, anyway. But so Whitey went to Modorano and said, "You got to help me out here, and you owe Billy O'Sullivan, who was dead by then." And so the deal was that Whitey would kill. It was brokered by Modorano and how he went there. That the Whitey and his gang would kill Whitey's boss, Killeen, and then they would merge the Mullen gang and the Killeens, what was left of them, and they would all be under the aegis of the Winter Hill gang in Somerville.
I think I was working in Washington by then, but I heard about this psychopathic killer who didn't trouble him in the least to blow people away. And he happened to be Bill Bulger's brother.
Right. Well... But he was just one of a crowd of people. I mean, he wasn't even in like the top tier of gangsters at that point, Chris, until like the mid 70s.
Exactly the point when I sort of returned here, and there was a new, incredibly powerful presence in the town, and who knows? But he was a big deal in South Boston. We're going to hear about it when we come back. We're going to take a vintage walk through South Boston in high old Whitey time. Open air beatings were routine business, but watch out when Whitey told you to get in the car. This is Open Source. Richard Maranick is a man of parts, sometime Massachusetts state trooper, before that an aspiring South Boston gangster, later locked up on an 18 to 20 year sentence for robbing armored trucks. I met Richard in a Norfolk prison classroom where we talked about reading Dostoevsky and wanting to write like him. Richard's an accomplished author by now. His first novel was titled Boyos, about a crime boss in Boston, believe it or not. His new book is a memoir called Resurrection. Richard took me on a walk through South Boston this week just to get the feel of Broadway at D Street back in the 1980s, which was cocaine time and Whitey time.
Whitey had a very vicious side to him. I drive down this street. This is West Broadway, Chris. I drive down this street with my friends, and we'd see up ahead a car pull over, and Whitey Bulger with somebody over the hood of that car beating the hell out of him right in the middle of the street.
Wow.
And maybe Kevin Weeks would be standing there, and we'd pull up and say, we'd get out of the car. You all set, Jimmy? Yeah, we're all set, boys. Thank you. Bang, 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 bang. And that's what he did. But that was typical. That was normal.
Who was the guy he was beating? Who would that have been?
Just somebody who owed him money. Somebody maybe ran his mouth about him somewhere, or maybe like a loan shark debt, or a bookmaking debt. Who knows? It could have been anything. We didn't stop and say, hey, Whitey, what was that about? No. It was just, okay, you okay, Whitey? Your hands all right? Yeah, fine. Okay, we're out of here. That's it. You want us to do it. No, I'm all set, guys. Thank you. Crack. That's what it was. And you go into Triple O's bar. We hit the different bars on this street where Sturgis Cleaners is right there. That was our bar called Streetlights. It was nicknamed Street Fights. That was our headquarters for my crew. But down the street was Triple O's. And you walk into Triple O's on any weekend night, and Whitey Bulger was always right to the right of the door, standing there with his arms crossed, watching the crowd, watching the bar. He walks and say, hey, Jimmy, how you doing? Boys, have a good night. Enjoy yourself. That's it. It was just a wonderful place to live. And you talk to anyone that was born and raised here, including my grandmother. She said, this is Southie is God's country. And I said, Grandma, does God really live in South Boston? And she looked me dead in the eye and pointed at me. She said, God lives in South Boston. And I never forgot it. This was Whitey's town. He was around. He was an entity. We'd see him two or three times a week going by. He'd slow down. Hey, guys, how you doing? What's up? You know, with me, pretty much, I think maybe because I was a former cop, he always kept his distance a little bit. But he was like, hey, Rick, how you doing? You know, wave to me. But I never had real conversations with him. If we approached him for something, usually one of the other guys would do the talking, you know. But the thing is, I saw a good side to this guy, too. He wasn't a monster. The guy was not a monster. He killed a lot of people, sure. Was he a good guy? No, he's not a good guy, but he wasn't the devil either. One time, I actually thought he was the devil, you know. We stayed on our toes. We were always on our toes. We avoided him as much as possible. I used the analogy in the old days. He was a cloud over South Boston, and every once in a while, a dark cloud, you see that lightning bolt come out and hit someplace. It'll be hopefully in the distance. Where that lightning bolt hit, someone's usually dead. The thing was, if that cloud was there, you didn't want to be underneath it. He grew up in the old Harbor Projects,
yep,
which is maybe a half a mile from here.
Public housing was middle class?
Yeah, middle class, lower middle class. This is how nice the old harbor was. I had a dream someday I would live in those projects. That's how nice they were. That's what I aspired to. I lived in the old colony for a while with my friends, the guys that I was running with, my gang, my crew, operated out of the old colony housing projects. And I'll tell you something. Hey, what's up? How you doing, honey? Good to see ya. I wear them all winter. All winter, I got the shorts on, you know. Good seeing you, Kimberly. All right, honey. Like, she's the daughter of one of my former associates.
What Rick Marinick learned as an up-and-coming gangster was that doing business with Whitey Bulger was in every way hazardous.
I proposed a business deal with one of my associates over here. We was one of the young and up-and-coming gangsters, basically. And we were going to go into a business enterprise together, but we had to clear it through Jimmy first. We had to clear it through Jim Bulger. He said no. He nixed it.
What were you going to do? And why ask Bulger?
At the time, cocaine was very big, 1979, 1980. And there's maybe 30 independent cocaine operators in South Boston at the time. So we had the great idea, like, why not put them under one umbrella, and the umbrella should be held by us, basically. All right? So have them all buy from us, and then we kick Bulger maybe 20%. That was the deal. We'll do all the dirty work. We'll get these guys in line and make them all buy from us, and we'll give him 20% just for the kindness of letting us operate in this territory, basically. He came back. He said no. See, he never dealt drugs. He shook people down. He ran protection. You dealt drugs, he would take money from you for dealing, for the right to deal those drugs. But he never distributed drugs himself,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
So he had nothing to do with that stuff at the time. He was mostly into shaking down these huge marijuana smugglers. Guys like that guy like LePierre. I think he was working with this guy Toomey. He was a federal prosecutor. I heard he was taking him down for $500,000 every 6 or 7 weeks. Because they're bringing in tons and tons of marijuana. He didn't want anything to do with cocaine, okay? Now, he tells us not to do it. He tells my friend, and you tell that Ricky, not to do it behind my back. And we're hanging at a park on D and 5th. Where's 5th Street? 5th Street's right down here. We used to hang in a park up here, and he pulled up in a car, and he took me for a ride.
Describe that moment.
When he told me to get in the car, first thing I said, no, I'm not going to. But you know what? A lot of times he drove by himself. He always drove. No one drove him. He drove himself. And when he pulled up in that bulletproof, armor-plated Chevy Impala that day, when I was in the corner with Dean Fifth, he said, Ricky, get in the car. I went, not getting in the car, Jimmy. And the guy I was with, my friend Frankie, said, that's all right, get in the car. He said, get in the car. So I got in the car. And it was Fifth Street. We came right up, right by where we're standing here. We stopped at these lights. There was a guy standing right over there. And he waved at him. He recognized Jimmy. And Jimmy just kind of lifted his fingers off the wheel. That's how we waved here. But he liked to be recognized. He liked to be recognized. And then we took a ride here, and he gave me a little lecture. We talked very calmly. We get up all the way up Broadway. We took a right onto Dorchester Street. And by the time we took another right, we'd made a big loop to get back to West 5th. Then the anger, the Jimmy Bulger, the scary Jimmy Bulger, started to come out. Mm. And that's when he told me, you know, no uncertain terms, this is the way it is. I know what you're up to. If you even think about doing it, next time, you see me, you're going to be in the trunk. I understand that. And he started screaming some more. I'm not going to say what he said. And that was it. I got out, and okay. That was it. And that's just what it was. It's just, you know, it's not like, oh, my God. You know, then, no. It's business. He told me. He's direct. If Jim Bulger said he was going to kill you, it's not euphemistically, oh, I'm going to kill you. No, he will kill you.
The story of Richard Marinick's many lives so far is titled Resurrection. It gets 5-star reviews on Amazon Books. Howie Carr, what is your ruling on Whitey Bulger's responsibility for drugs in South Boston? The claim used to be, even from the cops, that he kept heroin out of the town. But Michael Patrick McDonald wrote a very good book, All Souls, most of 20 years ago, in which he said Whitey had imprisoned his the McDonald generation in hard drugs and despair.
I agree with that. You know, he may not have, you know, dealt the drugs directly himself, but it all came out during the trial that he set up the whole system. He put right. those independents out of business. He put them
no
under,
freelancers like Richard Marinick trying to be.
Yeah, no, he got a guy named Billy Shea who handled it. He just died recently down in Florida. He set the whole thing up. He went to Whitey and said, "This is what I can do." He was basically looking for the same thing Richard was looking for, a franchise. And Whitey gave it to him. And yeah, so I remember the St. Patrick's Day breakfast in the 80s. You know, the Cardinal Law would be there, and he'd be there pompously talking about, and we've got to do something about the scourge of drugs that are just devastating the archdiocese. You know, I'm thinking to myself, does he not know who's in large part responsible for the scourge, at least in huge parts of his archdiocese?
Did the DEA not know? That's what I wonder.
DEA,
how
knew.
In the world did he get immunity being
they knew.
Chief of the drug cartel?
But the DEA knew. I mean, look at one of the bodies that they found down at Florian Hall was John McIntyre. And he was recruited by the DEA and the Quincy police as an informant on Whitey. And unfortunately, they knew that they shouldn't tell the FBI, but somebody dropped the ball and informed Whitey that McIntyre was about to flip. This was an FBI agent did this, and McIntyre's dead. I mean, the DEA did their best. And a lot of the Boston cops did their best. You knew Jack O'Donovan of the state police. He tried to do his best.
Oh, man, who stopped Whitey at the airport?
No. That's a different guy. That's Billy Johnson. Billy Johnson stops Whitey at the airport, taking out the money in the 1980s to Montreal. And Billy Johnson gets transferred out of the because he refuses to turn over his police report to one of Dukakis's hacks, Dave Davis. But Jack O'Donovan was the lieutenant colonel. He totally straight guy. He put the bug in Whitey's garage in the West End after they moved in from Somerville.
Yes, of course.
And then the quote unquote anonymous rider was added to the state budget to make O'Donovan retire. And who vetoed that, Chris?
You tell me.
Governor Ed King, who gets the bad rap as a hack. And who stopped John Connolly from becoming the Boston Police Commissioner?
Former Governor Bill Weld sat where you're sitting, Howie, with me in the studio. And I said, Bill Johnson, who ended up killing himself after...
This is the trooper at Logan.
Right. Yeah. I said, you were the commander-in-chief of those troopers. Where were you? And where are you now? Bill Weld went silent. And I let him stay silent. He refused to talk about it. Short form, the whole Bulger thing corrupted just about everybody.
Right.
In Republicans, Democrats.
But my whole point was that the only two politicians that I can remember standing up to him were Ed King and Ray Flynn, who stopped Connolly from becoming the police commissioner.
Give Mitt Romney credit. He fired him from UMass.
Yeah,
presidency.
But by that point, Whitey was on the lam. You know, I mean, the Bulger clan wasn't what it used to be at that point.
But when Bill Bulger took the fifth rather than talk about his connection to his brother on the lam,
right.
Romney finally said, "You're out of here." I want to introduce David Boeri, who needs no introduction to WBUR. David, my colleague in public broadcasting forever. We've been talking about the Bulgers for 35 years. What's your take on all of this drug connection and immunity for Whitey Bulger all those years?
You know, it doesn't get any more sordid than this. And this has been called the greatest scandal in American law enforcement, Chris, by a congressional committee. It's just stunning to look at the deal that was made. I mean, what's different? There are a lot of evil and violent people in the world, but what separates Bulger from the others is that he and his associate, Steve Fleming, were brought to us, sponsored by our own government. And you've been alluding to this. He was recruited. He was recruited along with Fleming as a secret, a top echelon secret informant. So he was protected.
Whose idea? Whose idea and to what end, David?
This goes back to the Justice Department and really goes back to the 1960s when Bobby Kennedy, as Attorney General, launched the war on organized crime. And Hoover, who hated the Kennedys but loved his job, said, yes, sir. And he started pulling agents, diverting all these agents that had been looking for commies in New York onto the mafia. That was the target, the mafia. And, of course, Bulger has the benefit of being part of the Irish gangs. So they bring him in and they bring Fleming in as well. They make them top echelon informants. They send them out. And what transpires is they get protected. And they get protected by the FBI. That's understandable. They'll be secret. But now, not only are they beating their rivals, the mafia guys, and taking more and more power, but suddenly the agents start enabling, empowering, and emboldening them. So they are actually now working to subvert any kind of investigations by
David,
the state police or the...
Yeah. This prompts my eternal question. What do Osama bin Laden and Whitey Bulger have in common?
Well, you know, arguably they're both state-produced, state-sponsored products.
Exactly. I mean, they are constructed by our national security state to not, as it turns out, to make us safe, but to keep us entertained. Endless amounts of money. And then suddenly, Osama's out there to chase the Russians out of Afghanistan. Whitey... chase the Italians out of crime in Boston.
Listen,
and then suddenly, when the story gets interesting, they disappear, both of them.
I don't know how tall bin Laden is. I forget that. But what I know is they took a guy who was 5'8" in Boston and made him a giant. And that was the Bureau. And, you know, at one point, Kevin Weeks told me that Bulger had said at one point, at any point in time, I can go up to the FBI office, pull 6 agents out, give them machine guns, and we could go on a hit. I mean, is it true? I don't know. I said to Weeks, and did he tell you who they were? He said, I didn't want to know.
Howie Carr.
But this was the stunning thing that of actually informing them of who was informing on them so that Bulger and Fleming could kill them. And they did that. And the agents that did that had to know what their consequences would be of telling them.
Give Howie Carr a shot at that theory.
Yeah, we know Kevin Cullen. He was a reporter for The Globe who worked on the Spotlight series. This is a story about how the FBI protected Whitey. Whitey was very concerned, the FBI was very concerned that they were working on this Spotlight story. So they send an FBI agent to Cullen, and they say, Whitey's going to kill you if the story runs. And Cullen is, of course, petrified, as we all were. And he says, who told you this? And the FBI agent says, he's not one of the major players, but one of the guys who was on the pad, I guess. And he says, Fat Tony Shula. And David will recognize what the beauty of that. And so Kevin Cullen says, well, can I speak to Fat Tony Shula? And the agent says, oh, I'm sorry. You know, he's in the witness protection program. No one can talk to him. So a few years later, Fat Tony Shula comes back to Boston. And, I was talking whether we were going to maybe do a story or something. And so one day I remembered that what happened to Cullen. And I said, by the way, did you ever tell the FBI or that Whitey was going to kill Kevin Cullen? And Fat Tony goes, who's Kevin Cullen?
Well, yeah, wait, and it goes...
at the bottom... Who still believes that Whitey Bulger was instrumental in the federal prosecution and conviction of the Italian mob in
Nobody.
Boston, the Angelos?
Well, Fleming was, his partner, Stephen Fleming, was much more important. And it would certainly appear that Bulger's value was inflated in the reports that the FBI agents were making, crediting him with things that really came from Fleming. That's pretty clear. But it was this sense that we're fighting the war on organized crime. We have these guys, and we're going to protect them. Then that then leads to the most sordid and scurrilous actions by people. Remember, operating under the motto, fidelity, bravery, integrity. The FBI, and as Howie points out about this, when this Globe Spotlight team. The head of the FBI lied, bold-faced lied. They lied to everyone in denying any relationship to Bulger. And there were lots of people that knew about that relationship. And worse yet, they turned on the families of the victims. They ignored them. They threatened them. They they just stonewalled and told him they knew nothing when, in fact, they knew exactly what had happened.
And Howie Carr.
And what happened to the guy who lied to the Spotlight team, the guy who was, they called him Vino because he became an alcoholic. They were paying him off over and over again, and he's the one who tipped off the gang, basically, so that they could kill Brian Halloran and Michael Donahue on Northern Avenue. What happened to him, David? You know what happened to him. He was promoted to become the head of the FBI Training Academy in Quantico, Virginia.
And so they kept on trying to contain this, maintaining, even to the point of the trial, maintaining it was just a couple of bad apples. When in fact, and these are the questions that you would have loved to know, how far up did this go? He argued, that Bulger argued through his defense that he had an immunity deal with the Crime Strike Force prosecutor. They wouldn't let him defend that at trial. We got very few answers at trial. He was convicted. Very few answers came. And where's the accountability? That's the main question. Where is the accountability for all those agents?
We'll talk about this. Everything we know about Whitey Bulger comes from the FBI, and all of the stories conflict. There was the innocent Whitey Bulger back in the day, and then there was the sort of Kaiser Sose embodiment of explosive evil at his trial. When we come back, what's never been told, even in the Whitey trial, about the FBI's collusion in his life, perhaps in his death, too. This is Open Source. David Boeri covered every day of Whitey Bulger's federal court trial for WBUR 5 years ago. By then, David, Whitey had long been an FBI celebrity, both a government informer and also number one on the most wanted list.
He has a violent temper and is charged with 19 murders. Call the tip line at 1-800-CALL-FBI.
Like a lot of people, David, you've felt that Bulger's conviction on 11 counts of murder was an understatement of the case. What got left out?
It was the accountability of all the others. The prosecutors had been hard-charging, but when it got to the trial, they repeated an ongoing theme here. Matthew 6:24, you could only serve two masters. And so they're prosecuting Bulger, but they soften it. They soften it in many ways. They say only a couple of bad apples. They actually went after good FBI agents who'd been called for the defense to testify. And they actually even gave cross-examined some of the victims' families in a way to minimize what had happened. So it was, there are all these questions. He was denied the chance to make this argument that he had immunity. It might have been ludicrous, but on the other hand, as every judge recognizes, everybody deserves a defense. They cut off his defense. The judge cut off his defense to make that. Who knows? It would have put him on the stand, inevitably. He would have been cross-examined. And you had this strange situation I've never seen, never expect to see again. The victims' families cheering on the defense attorneys for the man who had killed their loved ones because they believed that the defense was going to get to more answers that the prosecutors didn't want to come out of the courtroom. And they were cheering them on. That was a strange thing to behold.
Howie Carr, did you ever expect to hear the voice of Whitey Bulger at his own trial?
No, I disagree with David. I don't think he ever would have gone on the witness stand. I mean, the cross-examination would still be going on. There's no way he could have survived that.
No, but Howie, had he been allowed to make this argument that, in fact, he had gotten a deal, then he would have had to make that defense, he would have had to take the stand. And I understand what you're saying. There would have been withering cross-examination. Who knows? Fantasy on his part. There's a chance. You know, what's happened now, anything that he knew, any evidence that he could give is gone with him. And there was that chance. And the families were hoping to find out. And these families had been badly abused by the government. They were hoping to find out what had really happened. And the other part of this, Chris, is the deals that the government made with Bulger's associates to testify against Bulger. I mean, these were truly stunning. A guy like John Matarano, who has the conscience of a cockroach, you know, a multiple murderer given a very big deal, as all of them were, to testify against.
But again, David, there is no case, though, without Moderano flipping, because Moderano flips, then Weeks flips, and they fall down like dominoes.
But, you know, Mark Wolf, the federal judge, who had been in the U.S. Attorney's Office, had already written a report saying that the prosecutor's office had disgraced itself in its relationship with the arch criminal Whitey. Why should not that have been cross-examined, so to speak, at the trial? What was the relationship exactly? Not to mention the corruption of state police and Boston police over years.
If that judge hadn't turned over the stones to reveal the maggots, we might not know to this day that Bulger and Fleming were secret informants. In addition,
shouldn't that have been part of the trial record, is what I'm asking?
He didn't preside over the trial. The government made sure that Wolf did not preside over the trial for Bulger when he came back. And that's a story in itself.
But they made sure that he didn't do that. David, Mark Wolf, I think you obviously like him more than I do. I mean, he's a bit of a drama queen himself, isn't he?
Absolutely. But given this, Howie, if it weren't for him, he was the one that forced them to turn over the files that the government didn't want to release that indicated that those two guys were secret informants. And that blew the lid off. That was the first thing. And then, of course, when the bodies showed up in 2000, then your corroboration of what your witnesses are telling you, and the case moves forward fast at that point. I understand what you're saying. In addition, when the FBI agent, the star of the city, John Connolly,
Special prosecutor
comes in and he says, the statute of limitations may not allow me to prosecute a number of these agents, but let me tell you, I am going to launch a report. It's going to Congress, and we're going to settle all this stuff, and we're going to vent it, lay it out, even if we can't prosecute. I said, we asked him, when's that? He says, a couple of months later, where's the report? I'm going to need more time. Where's the report? That was 2000, 2001. Chris, we're still waiting for the report.
But let me ask you.
And this guy, by the way, no secret, this guy gets promoted to investigate the destruction of the CIA tapes, the torture tapes.
Let me
ask.
He
doesn't find any report there either.
Federal law enforcement is still on the spot in the death of Whitey Bulger. The transfer by the Bureau of Prisons to a nest of organized crime assassins. He's in the general population. He barely gets his first roll call when he's been gouged to death by fellow prisoners. I mean, who's covering up what? Howie?
This is the life he chose, to quote Michael Corleone, you know, and I'm not really that invested in the conspiracy theory.
I'm not saying novenas here. But the fact of the matter, this too is part of it, where the attention is on it closes the narratives. We're hearing who killed Whitey, who killed him. More importantly, and this is what I've always gone after, is how the hell did a guy get placed in a level 3, which is the prison, a level 3 for the most serious and violent people, put in there, an 89-year-old man. He's transferred there. He's been in solitary before. They put him in general population, and they can't protect him for a night. I understand what Howie's saying, but on the other hand, doesn't it just kind of invite conspiracies as to what's going on?
I think anybody can get killed in prison, though. You know, I mean, Moderano was going to kill Fleming. You know, I mean, they could have killed Fleming if they'd have wanted to. I mean, his Fleming's brother killed the Boston Strangler. You know, in Norfolk. So I mean. This can happen, and some of the stories that are coming out about this guy from Springfield. I mean, he had his own reasons, and you know what, David?
Oh, yeah.
He had nothing to lose. He's doing life without parole.
Well, that's the problem. That's right. In prison, there's no sanction for killing somebody else. Absolutely, but it's interesting how the government always wants to. has wanted to distance himself from Bulger. Couldn't distance themselves more. After the trial was over, Carmen Ortiz says, he's ancient history. It's good riddance. The U.S. attorney the other day says, when we heard of his death, we thought of the victims and their families. Hey, I've stood with the families. I've cried with them. I've been there. I understand their feelings. Absolutely. But for a U.S. attorney not to recognize that he has a professional duty to conduct investigations and find wrongdoing and say nothing about, we're going to find out what happened there. It's all the way along. It's been a failure of government from the Department of Justice going back to the greatest scandal in law enforcement history, according to the Congressional Committee.
David and Howie, what I'm missing in this story is the sort of social history behind the viciousness which the Bulger era preyed upon its own constituency. South Boston had passed its prime in a certain way, but along come merciless predators in the community, tearing the remains apart. That's the way I see it. Why? I mean, the precedent of John McCormick, the sort of pious House Speaker of the United States from South Boston, with his brother, Naco, the bartender, right. That was a sort of innocent precedent for the Bulger years. But this is something entirely different. What had happened out there?
But Chris, I think you grew up in South Boston,
no,
right?
No, I didn't. My father did.
Okay. But you know that before busing, there was a more of a middle class. Maybe
totally.
A
my father
class.
Was a gentleman of the old school, although he didn't finish eighth grade. But they were extraordinarily straight ahead, progressive, grateful, first generation Americans.
Right. But the chaos of busing was it parallel with the rise of both Bulgers, was it not?
I think that's probably right, but we only get to see that now.
Because Boston's middle class was hollowed out. Everybody went to the suburbs. So you just have a group of people that are left there that can't escape of whatever ethnic or racial background, and suddenly it's easier for predators like the Bulgers to take over. There's less pushback, isn't there?
Well, I think that's probably the story of a lot of communities.
Charlestown, too, of course. This is going to Charlestown, too, in other places.
And Dorchester and black communities where middle-class, you know, stalwarts of the town have left.
Right.
Paul McGonigal was the son of a man who was killed by Bulger. Teenager. Suddenly his father doesn't come home one night. He tells me that one day, all months later, he sees the ghost-like figure of Bulger. Bulger knows him. He knows Bulger. The car pulls up, and Bulger says to him, "You can calm down now, Paul. We got the guy that got your dad." Mm. I mean, that speaks to the terror. That speaks to the evil genius, I think you could say.
Yeah.
Speak to that terror, Holly Carr.
Well, I mean, there's another story with one of the McGonagalls right after the father disappeared, and the son told this story at the sentencing, and he called Whitey Satan, and what happened was it was right before Christmas, and you know the family was destitute. You can't even file an insurance claim without a body, right? So there's no money, there's no nothing. The phone rings, and the son picks up the phone, and it hears this voice on the other end. Yeah. Your father's not coming home for Christmas. And the kid says, "Who is this?" "Santa Claus." I mean, that's the kind of guy he was. I mean, if Jimmy Cagney had been written that line, he would have cut it out. He said, nobody's this sick. But it's a true story.
You two think that this is sort of in his last chapter, but I got to offer you just a quick analogy. 1919, great molasses flood, 25-foot wave of molasses kills a number of people. That's in 1919. 1960s, when I used to go to the North End, on a hot day, my aunt would come out and say, "Smell it, you can smell it." What's the lesson? History sticks. History sticks to, you know, and I think that all these years later, what happened here? What happened here is a scandal. It's not going to go away. I half expect Bulger to come back from the grave. He's been writing letters. Who knows what else he's been writing, what kind of documents he has. But he's definitely thought of the future in that. And, you know, it's as far as the Bureau is concerned, I mean, I think of the great Justice Louis Brandeis, who says crime is contagious. If the government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for the law. It invites everyone to become a law unto himself. It incites anarchy. That is the message you got to be thinking of about what this story tells.
Well said, David. But I am inclined to agree with Howie that this story is over. It's been over for a very long time. Write the last page, Howie. How did it end? What was the score? Was it part of the social history of sort of post-war America, post-war Boston?
Yeah, well, it was obviously that. And, you know, I know David really doesn't like John Matarano, but he did say, and I think it's true, it's perfect karma. I mean, this is a guy who was a rat, and he always thought that there was a very good chance this was how he was going to die, and he was taken out by and the other thing too, the irony is, I mean, he was taken out by somebody he never would have suspected would take him out. I mean, this guy, Gius, I guess it's pronounced. He was so far down on the ladder. I mean, no, Whitey Bulger never. I bet he never even heard of this guy, and he killed him.
Gius being the Springfield assassin in the prison in West Virginia.
If that's what they're investigating now. What's stunning is they never considered, as they're supposed to, when making transfers, who's in the prison. You know, we all know they're supposed to segregate the Crips from the Bloods. Here you got mafia guys in there, and not only that, but you have one guy who was convicted just this summer, along with Cadillac Frank Salemi, who was convicted of a long ago murder. And Salemi's
on the testimony of Flemmy, Whitey's partner.
That's right. Yeah. Well,
life goes on. You know,
here he is in the prison when Bulger's there. It's like, what's he doing, and why they're putting him in with mafia guys?
I was just going to say, walking through down Broadway with Richard Marinick this week, he said 37,000 South Bostonians are almost all new to the terrain. 5,000, what he would call real South Bostonians, there, and they're living in expensive apartments with a view of the water. It was a nightmare of the old residents. I mean, I remember 30, 40, 50 years ago, people thought, you know, this would make perfect, you know, beachy, high-rise apartments. It's there now, and I think life is going to go on in its very strange way.
Howie, you know what the irony is? If Bulger had stayed in South Boston, he would have made a killing in real estate.
Exactly. That's a good point.
He did make a killing. Different kind, though, obviously. Yeah.
Flemmy was the real estate expert, but yeah, he would have made a killing in real estate if he'd stayed there.
Give us your last words of the story, David.
I just can't get away from the responsibility of the government. Tom Foley, he was one of the good guys, and we should say there were good guys in law enforcement who tried to bring him down. I remember Foley when Bulger was convicted. Foley was out on the side. Everybody else was taking credit. He was on the side. He was retired then. He said, they don't get it. If law enforcement had been working back then, we never would have had a Whitey Bulger. And then he said, and the FBI is still doing it.
There were a lot of good guys in the story, maybe especially George Dare of the housing court, who refused to put a Bulger hack on his clerk list, and Bulger responded by cutting his budget, slashing his budget, and Governor Dukakis signed on to the cuts. And Dare commented, Bulger was running for president.
There's a bad guy, Mike Dukakis. I mean, he stood by. That's what I was making the point earlier, that, you know, Ed King gets this bad rap, Ray Flynn gets this bad rap, but those were the two guys, the only two politicians when they were at their maximum power that actually stood up to them.
And George Dare made Dukakis pay for it when he was running for president. He said, how is he going to stand up to the Russians if he can't stand up to the corrupt midget, if I dare use
that phrase, Howie?
He didn't have a copyright on that, so you can't accuse me of plagiarism. But yeah, that was the perfect phrase, a corrupt midget. That's what Billy Bulger was.
There was a lot of bad journalism around that guy, and we don't need to name them all, but I have to say, both of you were distinguished.
You paid the price too, Chris, and don't...
You know more about that price, but you were the standard of standing up, telling it, no matter. We lost our 10 o'clock news, we think. to the backhanded Bill Bulger.
I'll say you did.
Well, David, it was fun anyway, and we gave it our best shot. I want to thank all of you, Howie Carr, David Bowery, and my pal Richard Marinick. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Rebecca Panovka, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our top echelon FBI informer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.